Welcome to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon. I'm Shane Bacon. Quick apologies to start the podcast. If the audio has sounded a bit wonky the last few podcasts, I thought it might be a technical issue. And so me and my main man, Rich Cook, over at Fox, worked yesterday over a whole bunch of different things that could have been the issue. And we landed on one thing. I had the microphone too far from my face. It's just a reminder that I'm not a very smart human being. But again, hopefully the audio is a little bit better as we get rolling here in the Clubhouse. Reminder, if you want to get in touch with us, hit us up on Twitter at the Clubhouse Pod, at Shane Bacon. Use the hashtag ClubhouseSB if you have questions, comments, thoughts. We are in the middle of the tour season, really getting going. Obviously, this is Players Week, one of my favorite weeks of the year. Lengthier questions if you have them. Hit us up at the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon at gmail.com. And yes, we're here, TPC Sawgrass. I got a chance to play it a few years back. It is phenomenal, and it's really tough. I think that's what's super special about it is, you know, we know the back nine. We know the way that the golf tournament ends there with obviously the exciting par five, and then you get the par three, and, you know, 18's really tough, but that front hole location allows people to make birdies like we saw with Ricky Fowler, Kevin Kisner, those types of players. But, you know, the whole golf course is made for this, and I think that's what's so cool about it. It is a golf course that they built to host a big golf tournament, major or no major, fifth major, whatever you want to call it. I think it's the most exciting golf tournament we see week in, year in and year out, and I think we'll see another one this year. You know, you never know. Von Taylor is going to probably take another one. It is the year of the random winner so far in 2016. We saw it again last week with James Hahn showing us exactly why golf is a four-letter word. 8 missed cuts. And then he wins. You talk about no momentum. I think I might start ignoring momentum going into tournaments as I make my picks. I've told you a whole bunch of times that I might be the worst picker of golf winners ever. This is another reminder why. James Hahn wins. Ricky Fowler looked like he was going to roll it. But before we get to all that, let's get to some mailbag questions. A reminder, hit us up at the Clubhouse Pod. You can send them into the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon at gmail.com. Use the hashtag ClubhouseSB if you have a question. You Call Me Carlos said, what's the greatest moment in players' history? If 2015 hadn't happened, I think I'd go with Be the Right Club today. I just think that's such an iconic moment. You know, you're going to get people talk about the Tiger putt on 17. I loved the Hal Sutton win and the way he did it. I just thought it was super special. I thought the call was great. If you really think about it, probably one of the coolest calls from a player ever, especially with the mics picking it up. So, but I mean, you've got to go last year. 2015 was insane. I watched the 2015 Players Championship last night. Shout out to Golf Channel. Show an old golf tournament every night, Golf Channel. Seriously, just every night, pick an old golf tournament that people love. I don't understand. I don't know a single person that doesn't enjoy these things. That's how good they are. But a few takeaways that I had from the 2015 Players, things that I forgot. After Fowler makes that eagle on 16, he pulled out the Red Bull water bottle. He walked with it on 17 and 18, holding his Red Bull water bottle. And, you know, there's so many times that I look at Ricky Fowler's Snapchats or his tweets or anything like that, and all I think is, how is every sponsor not going after this guy? Because he's so good at it. He's like a marketer's dream. I mean, literally, just look at his Snapchat story for a week and see how many times he mentions Red Bull or Mercedes. I half expected him to drive a Mercedes golf cart down the middle of the 18th fairway. That's how impressed I was rewatching this and seeing him like rocking the Red Bull water bottle. I mean, this is stuff he doesn't, this isn't coincidence. He does this on purpose. He's a smart kid. He knows where the money comes from. So that was something I noticed. I forgot about Sergio's putt on 17. That was a bomb. I mean, they did a great job. NBC precedes it with this whole, well, I guess maybe this was for Golf Channel, but they showed Sergio over the years on the 17th. And obviously the good was, you know, the Guidos, and he hits it close after Guidos hits the water. The bad was in the playoff when he dumps it in the water, hits it in the middle of the green on top of the hill. No chance of really getting it that close, and he drains it. I mean, you know, Sergio, and this was after backing off his tee shot. People are rooting against Sergio, shocker. They're all calling for Fowler to win, rooting for Fowler. He had to back off a couple of shots, and then he makes that bomb on 17. It was pretty awesome. Bill Haas, second shot in 18, or into 16. He and Fowler took some gutsy lines with those second shots, obviously needing to make something happen. But man, they got some really, really lucky kicks. That's the kind of stuff that wins you golf tournaments, as we saw with Fowler. Haas, of course, couldn't make a couple of putts coming down, missed that eagle putt. But that ball landed about the only spot it could land with that fairway woody coming into the par five for it to get that close. And last thing I noticed and was laughing at from the 2015 Players' Championship, Kevin Kisner walks off 18, gives the baby the kiss. The wife goes in for the smooch, even puckers the lips out, and he gives her the ignore, the cold shoulder. Just walks right by. If you've got it on DVR, go up to that point. It was pretty funny. Of course, he didn't mean to, you know, give the ignore, of course, but it was pretty funny. He even went up and gave the mom a kiss, skips the wife. So a couple of observations, and since we're talking about the 2015 players, I thought it was a good point to talk about Fowler last week at the Wells Fargo. Sean Deal said, "What's up with Ricky on Sunday since his win earlier this year? Can't close or just a blip?" Listen, for some reason, people think that Ricky Fowler has a hard time closing out golf tournaments. It's not true. I mean, he hit a good shot on 17 at the Waste Management. I will stand on that hill as long as I can until my legs give out. He hit a perfect golf shot off the tee, got a bad kick off the back bunker, goes over the green. Never in a million years, I'm sure, did Ricky Fowler think that ball was going to go in the water. So, a bad break there, loses the Waste Management. But remember, we saw what he did last year at the Players in 2015. He basically birdied every hole he needed to and made an eagle too. So, that was about as clutch a performance as we've seen in years closing out a golf tournament. Then he goes to the Scottish Open. Birdie's the last hole at the Scottish Open to win that European Tour event, and that is obviously one of the biggest European Tour events out there because it's the week before the Scottish Open or the British Open. Everybody goes over there, plays in it, wants to get familiar with the course and the conditions in Lynx Golf. Birdie's the last hole, wins that event. His first win, the Wells Fargo, back in 2012, made a birdie in a playoff to beat Rory McIlroy in DA points. Hit a great wedge shot to a few feet, kicked that thing in for a birdie, and that was his first tour win. And, you know, if you look at the Deutsche Bank last year, Henrik Stenson was having a little bit of a meltdown himself. He was having his own issues, but Fowler calmly shot a back 933, didn't make a bogey, to win that as well, FedEx Cup Tour event. I mean, this is not a guy that we need to think about unclutch or unable to close. Sure, he hasn't closed out a 54-hole lead on the PGA Tour in his career. That's fine. A lot of this stuff happens to everybody. I mean, it really does. This goes back to the Spieth thing. Jordan Spieth, clutch. We've seen him close things out. Really impressive. Fell apart at the Masters for a hole and a half. And you really, if you think about Saturday, fell apart at the end of Saturday as well. I mean, really had a chance to take a big lead into Sunday and struggled to close that round out. Rory McIlroy had a three-shot lead earlier this year, couldn't close it out going into the final round. I just think that it's easy to look at somebody. Well, let's talk about the real issue here. Ricky Fowler doesn't have a major, and that's what people care about. I think that's insane. He's won big golf tournaments against the best in the world, all over the world. He's a really, 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 really good golfer. So, I don't know. I just think it's really funny that people still question his ability to be clutch or close out when most of his wins have come within those moments. So, I'm all in on Ricky Fowler. I really believe he's going to be number one, two, or three on my list of favorites at Oakmont. And why? And that's the next question. Clarence Alford said, "When Ricky's putter gets hot, is anyone in the world better than him?" I think there's still people that are equal to him, but I do think that Ricky Fowler's putting stroke, when things are clicking, when his swing is clicking, I think his stroke is as smooth and solid as anybody on the PGA Tour. You can look at the stats. He's solid in the stats. He's not leading the PGA Tour in putting. I think he's 11th in total putting. But he's a solid, solid putter, and he hits those putts firmly. He hits them with affirmation. They go dead center a lot of the time, and that's what's getting him in the conversation a lot of the time is these putts are so precise, and he's so confident over them that now that golf swing has become consistent, he's able to continue to put himself in the conversation week in and week out. So, yes, I think when his putter is hot, he's one of the best players in the world, if not the best, and he's at least equal with a lot of those players. And also, Ricky Fowler's sneaky long. We followed on PGA Tour Live last week at the Wells Fargo. He outdrove Rory a couple times, and I mean, he outdrove Rory with drives of 320, 330. I mean, these were bombs. Ricky's sneaky long. He's got all the tools. I mean, I just think that we need to ignore and forget about what's happened at some of the events and remember what he's done when he's gone on to win. And with all that said, you know what time it is. It's time for the winning tweet of the week. You saw this tweet. This is not someone I pulled out of the archives or pulled out of, you know, some no-name guy that has eight followers. PGA Tour player Zach Blair, 25 years old. He's played in 53 PGA Tour events. He's eclipsed $2 million so far in his early career. But more importantly, He got disqualified last week at the Wells Fargo for maybe the most amazing reason ever. He bent his putter after smacking himself in the head with it. Now, he went on to putt with that. You can't putt with a club that's non-conforming or that you've changed in a way. Of course, bending the putter means you changed it. Gets disqualified. And how does Blair respond to the news? PGA Tour media sends out a note saying Blair got disqualified in round two of the Wells Fargo. He responds with simply a gif of Woody Austin, the famous Woody Austin, slamming himself in the head with his putter multiple times. I'm pretty sure Zach Blair didn't go that hard at himself, but I just thought it was such a funny response. I mean, so many times we're expecting the "I'm so sorry," and he did do that. He did send out a long note saying, "I'm sorry, I need to control myself better." You've got to do that this day and age of 2016, it appears. But we've all got mad on the golf course. We've all thrown a golf club or cursed or smacked ourselves on the leg. Maybe we haven't hit ourselves in the head with our putters, but every golfer in the world understands frustration. That's how frustrating this game is. It's impossible. Go to the driving range, look around, see how many golf shots you see that are even remotely solid if you watch 30 people on the range for 30 minutes. I mean, it is a really, really hard and frustrating game, and even a perfect day, a one swing can ruin it. And I just think it's funny that when these things happen, people freak out. And it got me thinking, what are the five biggest golf meltdowns of all time? I asked that on Twitter. You guys were great with the responses. Shout out to Adam Sarzen. The dude sent in some GIFs of Sergio I'd never even seen before. But Charlie Kane got it going. He sent a YouTube. I'd never seen this. Spencer Levine, 2011 AT&T National. And again, if you go to my Twitter account, at Shane Bacon, and you look for the conversation about the meltdowns, these are all replies, so you can find them pretty easily. Levine calmly walks off the green, and then he drop-kicked his own hat. I've seen people get mad at their golf clubs, their bags, their clip putters. Never seen the guy go with the dropkick hat before, so I thought that was unique and needed a place on the list. Number four, maybe the most athletic meltdown ever. Rory McIlroy at Doral last year. It's the most looped vine I've ever put out. That's something I'm going to put on my tombstone. Distance he got with that thing, you can tell he's been in the weight room. Cliche moment of the day. Rory works out. Number three, maybe not one you've seen a ton, a little underground. Henny Otto, the 2005 Nashua Masters, has maybe 18 feet, misses it. Looks like he's going to go full John Daly and smack the ball right off the green. Goes full swing, probably club head speed right on 90 with the putter, but goes over the ball, doesn't smack the ball, just acts like he's going to. Then he goes to tap it in. He's probably got 5 feet. Now that one misses, rolls the right lip. Now he's got about 3 inches, backhands it, misses it. Now he's got about a foot, one hand, misses it. The whole time, one of his playing partners is standing right there ready to putt out. Now Otto has to make about a 8-footer for a 5-putt. That one doesn't go in. It's a 6-putt from 18 feet. It was incredible. You can look it up on YouTube, and I would suggest it, and I would push you to do that, because it's just, you can just see everything falling apart between his ears in a matter of seconds. Henny Otto, well done. Number two, and I just put Sergio. I mean, you could do the same as about John Daly, but take your pick. I mean, loses his mind in a bunker. He threw an iron. No-look throw an iron in the lake. Really good distance on that one as well. His first year on tour, he flipped out on his Adidas golf shoe, took them off, threw them, kicked them. Of course, the spitting incident, which is a little bit uglier because it's not as fun to talk about, because that was a little bit more intense, of course, with the Jimmy Roberts interview after. I love Sergio Garcia. How do people not like the guy? He's crazy. He's fun. He's exciting. He's talented. He says sometimes he doesn't think he can win majors. He's won a whole bunch of golf tournaments. I really, really enjoy Sergio Garcia. He's own part on this list, so congrats, Sergio. And then number one, of course, number one is Woody Austin. The Woody Austin putter meltdown will never get beat. It's like Tiger at Augusta or Tiger at Pebble. It's just unbeatable. Nobody's ever going to get that record. Nobody's ever going to play that well against the field. Woody Austin, he's wearing an American flag polo. And he's smoking himself in the head. This is the most American thing ever. You can do that in this country. Hit yourself in the head with your putter. It's fine. So Woody Austin, the winner of the biggest meltdowns. And Zach Blair, your winning tweet, pointing us to Woody Austin, which got us talking on this subject and of this topic. And it was just a fun week, really, at the Wells Fargo. You know, James Hahn obviously might not be the sexiest name out there, but he played some great golf down the stretch, hit some great shots in that playoff. So congrats to him. And we're here. It's Players Week, and it's going to get going, and we've got some great groups. And we figured it'd be smart to bring on somebody that's won this golf tournament before. So I'm excited to bring on Craig Perks, obviously a Players Champion. Really probably the best finish in Players Championship history until last year. So I'm going to ask him how much he dislikes Ricky Fowler and really how he took his place there. But two chip-ins the last three holes, chip-in on 16, chip-in on 18 for par. It was pretty cool, and he got the trophy from Tiger Woods. So Craig Perks, part of PGA Tour Live, does a ton of broadcasting for Golf Channel. One of the best voices, maybe the best golf nickname of all time. So excited to talk with Craig Perks. And again, if you have questions, if you have comments, anything you want, hit us up on Twitter, the Clubhouse at the Clubhouse Pod, or at me, at Shane Bacon. Use the hashtag ClubhouseSB. And we'll get to some of your questions next week. We've got some fun guests rolling out over the next little bit as we approach nearer and nearer to Oakmont. So stick around. Up next is Mr. Craig Perks. And we welcome you into the Clubhouse Podcast. Craig Perks is here, 49 years old, from New Zealand, the 2002 Players Champion. And 49 years old, Craig, is it still kind of weird to hear that? I feel like I still picture you as this young guy with the hat sweep on 16.
Shane, I am feeling old, I can tell you that. And although the memories of that wonderful 2002 are vivid, it does seem like a few generations ago that I sort of pulled off a miracle down there in Ponte Vedra Beach.
Well, I ask all my players or current players, broadcasters, the first question is, what have you had to eat today? So, Perksy, what have you had to eat today?
I'm not sure if I've ever been asked that before, Shane. Actually, I was invited to participate in the broadcaster's luncheon. So some ahi tuna was on the menu, chicken salad wrap, and I had to sneak in an oatmeal cookie after eating such good, healthy food. I had to ruin it.
Well, that's pretty healthy. That's okay. You can have one cheat side to it. I wanted to get into the players, but I wanted to ask you first. I think you have the best nickname in all of golf. And obviously, I mentioned New Zealand. You live in Louisiana. Where did your nickname come about?
Well, Shane, it's interesting, actually. Cajun Kiwi came about. After I finally made it through Q school in my 10th try, we were at the rookie, I guess you could call it a rookie symposium. Part of that way back in the day, that was late 1999, the PGA Tour was providing us with a laptop and we needed a email address to so they could pass all the pertinent information on. So I was sitting there overwhelmed, finally accomplished the goal, realized the goal of making the tour, and for some reason I came up with Cajun Kiwi at PGATour.com, and it stuck, and it's something that I've used many times throughout the years. It's my Twitter handle, and I think it's appropriate. I left New Zealand when I was 18. I came to this country with a vision of playing on the PGA Tour, and throughout that process, I transferred in college to Lafayette, Louisiana, down there in Cajun country, which really I consider it my home, and it just sort of stuck. So Cajun Kiwi has really been with me since the end of 2009, early 1999, early 2000.
Well, I hope you didn't just give away your email address for everybody listening. And
I really hope they contact me. ask any questions they want.
Okay? Perfect. You live in Louisiana. You've mentioned that college there. What countries have people thought you've come from? What countries have you gotten over the years when people say, "Are you from blank?"
Well, most of the time it's Australia, and you know we're sort of looked down upon if you ask an Australian if they're from New Zealand, then they will certainly frown and growl at you. I'm not quite that perturbed when people say I'm Australian. Although I can say this, Shane, someone asked me if you could drive from New Zealand to Australia. That got a quizzical look. Scottish, Irish, but most of the time, South African occasionally, but, you know, the South Africans certainly have a unique accent. Australians, I always call it, they have a very sort of a harsh twang to their accent, and we just speak properly. We speak the Queen's English. So after I inform, they listen to me talk for a little while, I correct them if they are, say Australia, and then we finally do get a New Zealand.
Well, I wanted to get into the players. Obviously, it's Players Week, one of the toughest fields of the year, if not the toughest field. You're obviously a champion coming from there, and it seems like every week when the Players' Championship comes around every year, the conversation turns to, should it be a fifth major? Is it the fifth major? All of that stuff. My question for you is, do the players look at winning the Players' Championship differently than other tour events, like they look at winning majors differently?
Yeah, to your point, Shane, I think it's sort of in the discussion to be the fifth major. I'm glad it's not, even though I am a Players' Champion. I will say it's a major accomplishment to win the Players' Championship. I think that if you polled players or asked them, they would obviously prefer to win one of the four majors. We lack tradition, I think, in this championship. Just the 43rd playing of the Players' Championship this week. You know, you go back to the U.S. Open and the Open Championship. You know, they've been going on for more than a century. PGA and obviously the Masters. The Masters, what, began in 1936 or early mid-30s or whatever. So we just don't have enough time in the game as a marquee event or a major championship. Players certainly work their schedule around getting prepared for the Players' Championship. I do notice this, and I'm not trying to knock the event. Everyone, as they're preparing throughout the early part of the season, they're getting ready for Augusta. And then once you exit Magnolia Lane, and then people, although the Players' Championship is, you know, within a month of the playing of the at Augusta National, people are still working towards the U.S. Open. And then once the U.S. Open's over, then they're getting their games prepared for Link-style golf. And then it's what's glory last shot there at the PGA. So I don't think we have enough time, enough tradition, but it's a major event. It's a huge event, you know, and you think of it has all the necessary requirements. You know, you talked about the strength of the field. It is the strongest field in golf. You know, there's no Monday qualifiers. There's no qualifiers like regional and sectional qualifying that you go through in the Open Championship and the U.S. Open. There's no PGA of America club pros in the field, as is the case at the PGA. So, you know, you add in the atmosphere, that the Coliseum, the stadium type environment. So it has all the necessary requirements. I just don't think it's been around long enough to constitute being called a major championship.
Yeah, and you know, you think about, you know, I was watching video of you to prepare for this. I actually do prepare for stuff sometimes. And, you know, Tiger presents you with the trophy, the defending champion, much like you see a defending champion at the Masters present the jacket there. And also the three-hole playoff. I mean, there are little things that separate it from just the everyday run-of-the-mill PGA Tour event. And, you know, we look at this event as such a fun week. And I was going to ask, why does it seem that every year when we get to the end of the season, you look back and 9 times out of 10, the Players' Championship was the most fun event of the year? Why is it the players that always seems to bring out not just the best in the players, but it seems to bring out the most drama in an event?
Well, I think it's the strength of field, Shane. Yeah, I mean, you could – I remember vividly back a month ago at Augusta – when you're sort of handicapping that field, there might have been 10 or 12 guys that had a legitimate chance. If you look at the list of champions that have won, even if you go back to when I won in 2002, you wouldn't expect certainly you wouldn't have expected me to win. I was the 200th ranked player in the world. You could maybe look at Stephen Ames in 2006, maybe Tim Clark in 2010. And then Matt Kuchar, if you look a couple of years ago, that was his biggest accomplishment in his, you know, decorated resume. I think the strength of field, so you get into this event and maybe 50, 60 guys, 70 guys have a chance to win this golf tournament. There's no advantage at this golf course. It doesn't necessarily suit anybody. It rewards those that are playing well, that can, you know, have good shot making skills, can move the ball both directions, can work the magic around the greens. But it doesn't. It's not a bomber's paradise, you know, and it's not a ball striker's paradise per se. Although greens and regulation, I think, is important. I just think it's a golf course that will reward a well-rounded performance, and with the strength of field, I think it can be anybody. You know, you certainly wouldn't have thought Ricky Fowler would have, you know, broken through for the second time. What did he get that moniker of being the most overrated in that anonymous poll prior to the event last year? We didn't really think of Ricky Fowler in that category of being a player's champion, but you know, the year before, you think of Martin Keimer went on to win the U.S. Open at Pinehurst. So I think it suits everybody, and it doesn't, to a point, it doesn't pick out a certain style of player and give them any sort of benefit over a different type of player. It really suits everyone as long as you're at the top of their game.
Okay, so let's go back to 02 for a minute. I know you talk about the 2002 players a lot, so forgive me, but I wanted to go over a couple things. Like I said, I was watching some video of some highlights, and up until 16 on Sunday, you'd had a bit of a roller coaster round. I think you'd be the first to say, 15 you missed.
That's an understatement for sure.
I think 15, you even admitted you missed an 18-inch putt there. It looked like a little push. And what happens? You're walking from 15 again, not hit a lot of fairways, haven't had a very consistent round. You're still in this thing to an extent. What clicked or what happened to you mentally to get on that 16th tee and hit, as you've said, the best drive of your life, give yourself a chance at eagle, and then go on and make that three? I mean, how did you get in that mode to close this event out the way you closed it out?
Yeah, you have been doing the work, Shane. It's very perceptive. I'd actually missed a very short putt similar to the one at 15 I missed on 12. And the greens had really baked out that afternoon. It would become an exceedingly difficult golf course. The mindset I had after missing the short putt on 15 was that I was really doing a good job. And it's a cliche, and I've said this for now 14 years. I really did a good job of staying in the moment. I walked onto that tee, and you're right, I'd only hit three fairways the entire day. But the good thing about it is, though most of my tee shots were offline, they were solid. I just stood up on 16, and I'll never forget in my mind, you know, I was visualizing the shot going through my normal pre-shot routine, obviously with the pressure and of the moment ratcheted up and the adrenaline pumping and the nerves there. I just said, hit the best drive of your life. And I visualized the shot right over the corner of the tree. I was comfortable moving it from right to left, and I pulled it off. As soon as I hit it, it was right out of the center of the club. It was right on my intended line. I really didn't even have to watch it. And that set in play what transpired from that point on. If I'd hit a poor tee shot there and had to lay up, then, you know, obviously I wouldn't have made a three, and I still would have been one back. And when you try to birdie one of the last two holes to at least get into a playoff, it's very difficult. But the tee shot set everything in motion for what happened after that.
So you hit a second shot just a little right of the green. It stops in the rough. You chip that in. The celebration was great, by the way. I think I watched it two times. You did kind of the Tiger fist pump. You did kind of the hat sweep. I think you really incorporated about eight legends celebratory moves into that little walk from 16 to 17. But, you know, you walk over to 17, and obviously your emotions have to be running really high. Is that the most pressure you ever felt over a golf shot, having hit that that tee shot on the par three, knowing that now you're back in this thing with a chance to win?
I wouldn't say the most pressure, Shane. I was as nervous as I had ever been, but to a point, I was embracing the atmosphere. That's a wonderful walk from 16 green to 17. You're in amongst the fans. It was a raucous style atmosphere. I was high-fiving and slapping people's hands as you walked by, knowing what was in front of me. 17. I'd watched this event, as we all had, the carnage that had happened there. I had a good plan. I really was never going to attack that flag. I had a good number standing up on the tee. And I just remember, yes, was I having trouble breathing? Yes. Was I having trouble getting saliva? Yes. But it seemed as though once I walked onto the tee, I looked at the hole location, we looked at my yardage book, I got a number in mind immediately. Then I backed off and went, got some water by the cooler over there. And then there was a peacefulness that came over me, a calmness that came over, and there wasn't any, you can do this, you know, you've got a chance to win the place. There was none of that. I was just very much in tune with my emotions. I was focused on what I had to do, and I felt comfortable that I could pull this shot off. And there was a NBC placard on the tower, or the shot link tower, behind the green. I aimed at the end, which was basically right in the center of the green. The ball took off right at the end of the NBC. I had hit it solid, so I felt comfortable that it was going to find land. And then the walk down that 17th hole, you know, it's probably 150 yards from tee getting to the green. That's really what makes this event. It's that environment. It's that stadium atmosphere. It's electric. Everyone is cheering for this underdog that no one has any idea who he is. And he's pulling off these miracle shots. And I really did enjoy it. I wasn't overwhelmed. I've been more nervous and stressed out trying to make a cut, which is where I spent most of my career on the PGA Tour. So I was playing well. I was embracing the moment, but there was obviously still work to be done.
So you make a birdie. You said you weren't trying to make it, which I loved. You make two on 17. So now you've got an eagle birdie on 16, 17, final day of the Players. You pull driver on 18. And Johnny Miller said what?
He said multiple things, but I think he called me idiotic. And I think he said that I'd left my brain in the bayou as well. Again, there was a calmness. My father introduced me to this game, and he had passed away in 95. I hadn't actually turned pro, but I'd played the mini tours. He'd never seen me play on the PGA Tour. So after I made the putt at 17, my caddy, I'll never forget, my caddy sort of came behind me instinctively. I just handed the putter to him, and I sort of just stopped for a second and just sort of, you know, looked skyward, and I said, "Dad, just guide me home." The reason why I hit drive on 18 was this, Shane. I didn't know how to win a golf tournament. You know, I hadn't won any. I played 4 years on the web.com tour, although I'd been in a couple of playoffs. I hadn't won on that tour. So I was still trying to post a score. There was never a thought, I've got a two-shot lead, I could hit a 5-iron and a 9-iron and wedge it on. I had played three practice rounds, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I'd hit driver every single round. I'd played three competitive rounds. Remember, this was my first start at the Players' Championship. I'd hit driver in the first three rounds. So I didn't, there wasn't a hesitation of what club I was going to hit, because I didn't know what club I should hit, and I didn't know what the line I should take. I knew exactly what I need to do with driver. Again, I have a propensity to miss a lot of fairways. Again, I hit it solid. I just didn't start it on my intended line. It should set up well for me. I like to hit the draw right to left, and I just blocked it. And obviously, that's the right place to miss it, but it was an inopportune time because I sort of got into more trouble than I really wanted to be in.
So you were smart. I mean, you pitched out, and then you hit a third shot over the green, and you're over the green. You just chip in on 16 from somewhat heavy rough, and you're over the green on 18. You had this pitch shot for a par. Are you thinking, I'm going to hold this out?
No, and on the flip side of that, Shane, I never thought that, oh, no, I'm blowing this event. I had a two-shot lead and wide overhead driver. If I don't get this up and down, I'm making six and I'm going into a playoff with Steven. I never thought that. The short game was the strength of my game. I was probably had one of the best short games or the most reliable short games on tour. I didn't have the flair, the hit shots like Phil Mickelson, but I was just very consistent. And then when I walked over the green, the lie was, it was rough back then. Remember, we played in March in 2002. There was rough, overseeded rough back there. It was sitting okay. It was on a slight upslope. And if you do happen to pay attention to the footage of that shot, you'll see the flag is fluttering back towards me. So it was back into the wind. I got up there and instinctively just reacted to what I saw. There was no second guessing, no trying to land it in a certain spot. I knew exactly the shot I wanted to play. I was going to open it was a 60 degree wedge, but it was 58 degrees. I was going to open it up. I was going to play it similar to a bunker shot. And it was struck perfectly. It landed very softly. There wasn't a lot of green to work with it with that back left hole location. I had no intention to hole it, but obviously it added to the lore with the two chip-ins and the one putt on those final three holes.
What was the most random message you got after that win congratulating you? Did you get anybody that was completely off the wall?
Well, Donald Trump called me the next morning.
A Donald Trump call? That's the first one on the podcast.
Well, I'd played with him at AT&T in the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. So I spent 3 days with Donald, and he called me. It was funny because I was in this, you'll think I'm crazy, but my life had changed. I didn't understand the magnitude that it had. I was out mowing the lawn the next morning, like I would normally do. I was playing Houston. I was going to just drive over there on Tuesday afternoon. I was being a good father and husband, mowing the lawn, and Maureen was fielding. I didn't understand. The phone was ringing off the hook, just nonstop. And I didn't have an agent at that point, someone who could sort of deflect all of those messages. My wife was answering. Then Donald Trump's secretary called and said, "Hi, this is Donald Trump's secretary. Mr. Trump would like to speak to Craig." Well, my wife thought it was her best friend in high school, so she said, "Come on, Rebecca, quit fooling me." And she hung up on Donald Trump's secretary. So he called back immediately, and I talked to Donald for, 10 minutes, and that was one of probably 500 or 600 calls that I received that day. It was overwhelming, Shane, to be honest with you. People from, Bob Charles called me, who was sort of my idol growing up. Obviously, Sir Bob Charles now, he won the Open Championship, a New Zealander. Won the Open in 63. Just Steve Elkington, who had won the championship twice, text mess, something that I was just unfamiliar with. And it was, as I said, it was overwhelming. I was in awe of the notoriety and the publicity that I was getting. And it may have led to sort of my demise, to be honest with you, because I felt like from that point on, I had to be someone that I really wasn't. I had to live up to being a player's champion, and the likes of the Nicklauses and the Fred Couples, and as I mentioned, Elkington and Sutton and Davis Love and Tiger and all these guys that had won this championship, and here my name was amongst them.
Did you send Ricky Fowler any hate mail or mean tweets when he went eagle birdie birdie to eclipse your 9 strokes on the final three holes last year?
He played the last four holes in 11 strokes. It was funny, Shane. I was a fan last year. I played in this event for 6 years. And then once I stepped away from the game, I was broadcasting it the very next year. And all the way up until last year, I'd been here. Well, my daughter just finished her freshman year in college. I went up and helped her pack up, and we drove home together. So I got home Thursday night, and I became a fan. But my phone on Sunday evening after Ricky played those last six holes in regulation and 6 under, and then his last 10 holes and 8 under, I graciously stepped aside. I said, you know, I had a great run there for a little while as the greatest finish in quote unquote major championship history. And I gladly stepped aside to what Ricky Fowler was able to do coming down the stretch. What he did was pretty remarkable.
You mentioned that this golf course, TPC Sawgrass, doesn't really play into one string. So it's not a bomber's golf course. It's not like Augusta where, you know, if you move the ball right to left, you have an obvious advantage just starting off. If there is one thing that's got to be as sharp as possible, is it your short game just because the course can play so tough? Or is there just really not one thing? It's just got to be a complete mix. And with that being said, why is Sergio Garcia, of all people, the guy that seems to be so consistent at Sawgrass?
Two things, Shane. I think the iron play has to be top shelf. And I think the scrambling, when you do miss a green, you have a propensity around these segmented or, you know, these greens that are all in small quadrants. You have the tendency to shortside yourself. You don't have to drive it straight around this golf course. And I think with the way it's playing this year, it's firm and fast. You'll see players hit much less than driver off a lot of these tees. And you don't have to putt great. You really don't. I think putting is a real neutralizer out here. From an historical standpoint, you know, Ricky Fowler was 20th in strokes gained putting. Tiger, when he won a couple of years ago, was 38. So you don't have to drive it great. You don't have to putt good. So that's sort of, and I'm not saying Sergio doesn't drive it great, but Sergio is a great iron player. And his short game, he's Spanish, right? So he's sort of got that moniker, you know, if you go from Seve to Jose Marie Olazabal, they had great short games. They have the creativity and the flair around the greens, but you don't have to putt great. So that sort of lends its weight to Sergio. If you look at this golf course and you break it down, Dustin Johnson and Rory McIlroy and Adam Scott potentially, their power is neutralized. So everyone is pretty much hitting their second shots into the green, let's say on par fours, from the same spot. So then there's a little bit more importance on the iron game. And then you do have to have a good short game, I think, because of, as I mentioned, the severity of these greens. So, yeah, Sergio is right. I mean, what is he? I think he's the all-time leading money winner at this particular golf tournament with just one win. And I wouldn't be surprised if he lost in the playoff last year. He was third the previous hour. I would not be surprised if he's in the mix again this year.
Sergio loves this golf course. A lot of people are confused by it. Phil Mickelson obviously famously said after his win, I think a couple of years later, he said, I don't even know how I won this golf tournament. That's how hard it plays at times. We know 17, we know 18. 18, one of the toughest closing holes on the PGA Tour. What's the hardest hole outside of those last two that people don't talk about a lot there at Sawgrass?
Well, there's a really good collection of par fours out there, Shane. I would say that the fifth hole in the front nine is an important one with trouble lurking both right and left and quite a severe green if you get out of position. But I would also say similarly to 14. 14 is a long par four that sort of sets up that run home. It's 481 yards, the longest par four on that back nine. And we've seen trouble there because it's a generous fairway, but it's sort of cut in half. There's a high level to the fairway on the right and a low level on the left. But if you sort of hook it too much down that left side, you could run not only into the waste area or the bunker left, there's water. And if you decide to go up onto the right side, there's some severe mounding up there with some pretty nasty rough. So, you know, you can break this golf. The par fives are where you can take advantage of the stadium course. There's the nice variety of par threes, you know, beginning with the eighth hole, which is, can play 240 yards to the 132-yard legendary Island Green. But I think that the good thing about this golf course is there's a really good variety of par fours, and there's several that you can take advantage of. But as I mentioned, five, Five is difficult. You know, and then you get to even 15, which is sort of nondescript, but it can wreak havoc if you get out of position. So I think the 5 and 14 are ones, certainly the par 4s, that you need to pay attention to.
Turn to the tour for just a minute, the 2016 season. Is this going to be a year we remember as the year of the random champion?
Well, I saw a great graphic. I had a week off last week and saw this graphic, like, who would believe that Vaughn Taylor, Jim Herman, Brian Stewart had something that Rory McIlroy, Justin Rose, Dustin Johnson didn't have? You know, these guys haven't won. And I don't know if it's random, to be honest with you, Shane. You know, I think the way the season started with Emiliano Grillo, you know, right out of the Web.com Tour Finals, and then Smiley Kaufman, man, what a great story. And then Justin Thomas breaking through, and Russell Knox, and, you know, Graham McDowell finding some lightning in a bottle there in that playoff in Maricopa. I talked about the strength of field at the Players' Championship. That's why you get a plethora of different types of players. I think it's the same thing now with the PGA Tour. The depth of these fields that play week in and week out, you know, is just remarkable. The level of play has really ratcheted up. And these guys are prepared and so ready to win, you know, when they come out as 21, 22, 23, 24-year-olds. And, you know, the competition is really great. And the quality of these young guys, they're not intimidated. You know, I know that when I first came out on tour, Shane, I looked upon the, you know, whether it was Phil or Ernie or Tiger or Davis Love or Retief Goosen or the like, these were mythical figures to me. I was intimidated when I showed up to my first event in January 2000 at the Sony. These young kids are not intimidated. You know, they may have been playing against them, whether it was AJGA events or junior golf or throughout college, and they've been the saturation of golf now on TV. We're seeing so much more golf, and then the guys go hang out in Jupiter and they go play with all the best players in the world. So Brooks Koepka, when he shows up, or Ricky Fowler or Jordan Spieth or Justin Thompson, they're not intimidated. These guys have a lot of confidence. They have belief in their own abilities. They are prepared to be successful. I think it's great. Now, you're always going to get the Jim Hermans and the Brian Stewarts, which are great stories because they grind it out, and no one knows who they are. As the same thing with me, no one knew who I was. But you know, we just keep plying our trade and keep working hard and try to play to the best of our potential. And one of those weeks, you chip in a few times and make a few putts, and something magical happens. And I like to see that. I don't want to see, you know, back in the day when, not that it was bad for golf, but when Tiger won 9 times a year or Vijay was winning 9 times. And, you know, I like to see that these random people come out and just show everyone, all of the casual fans or, you know, the avid fans, that everyone that plays on the PGA Tour is great. It's just a matter of if they can get the good breaks to finally cross the line and get the crystal.
Now, do you still play golf at all?
Infrequently. I play when the timing is right, when the foursome or fivesome are a good bunch of blokes, and if there's a few nice cold beverages to help me aim the ball correctly and to lower my expectations.
You told me that you played not too long ago, had a few beers, and were playing at tour level. And I think the story ends with when you stopped with the beers, the game went south quickly. Is that your swing oil these days?
It is the swing oil. Yeah, I always say it's aiming juice. you know, I like to go out there what I like to see with these young guys. They look like they're enjoying themselves in the heat of competition. I probably wasn't as talented as all of those guys. I had to work my rear end off just to sort of get to the tour. But no, I enjoy just a lighthearted atmosphere. I played competitive golf. It was my job for 15 years, and I gave it everything I had, and now it's just fun to go out and tell a few lies, you know, speak in hyperbole occasionally, and just cut up and have a little fun. And that was something I didn't really do when I was playing inside the ropes on the PGA Tour.
Well, Craig, I appreciate it. I've really enjoyed working with you on PGA Tour Live. You missed out on PGA Tour Live last week. Me and John McGinnis. John McGinnis dropped a Naughty by Nature line on air, and we had a few of the other announcers a bit confused at who Naughty by Nature was, and I said probably the first time a 90s rap group has been dropped on PGA Tour Live since it came about. But I appreciate you coming on and talking a little O2 and a little 2016, and we will look for you not only on PGA Tour Live, but Golf Channel. You're calling golf quite a bit. What's your next event?
Yeah, I'm actually working this week, Shane, at the Players Championship, doing the PGA Tour Live featured group. And then I will, our web.com tour season on Golf Channel kicked off a couple of weeks ago in Evansville. We'll head to Greenville next week for the BMW Charity Pro-Am, that unique format that's similar to Pebble Beach, where they play multiple courses with some celebrities and amateurs, and then actually doing Colonial and Memorial for Golf Channel. So I've got a nice little stretch coming up.
Well, nice. Well, we appreciate it. And you can find you. It's at Cajun Kiwi. Is that the Twitter account?
That's right, at Cajun Kiwi.
There you go. That's Craig Perks. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Shane. Good to be with you.
Well, many thanks to Craig Perks. I really appreciate him. He's been really busy this week, so it was nice of him to take a few minutes out. When you win the Players' Championship, people want you around Players' Championship week. So A lot of fun talking to him. A lot of fun to kind of like look back on, you know, his win, and then kind of like look ahead and look at the landscape of golf these days since he's around it so much. We'll be back next week. Like I said, a lot going on. We've got the four ball coming up on Fox. Really excited about that. And then we roll into Oakmont. So the golf season is heating up, and we will continue to roll out these podcasts. If you like it, do us a favor. Subscribe to it. Write a review on iTunes. It really helps boost the pod. We appreciate it if you do it. I think the IRS will give you a $5 tax break next year. I'm not certain on that, but I believe that's true. So do that for us, and we'll be back next week.